All right, good morning, everyone. I haven't seen everyone from the front yet. My name is Evan Carroll, and I'm principal at Build Architecture in Portland, Maine. And I am a Maine licensed architect, member of the American Institute of Architects. And I'm going to talk about a program I did to learn about nursing homes firsthand. I participated, as Rosie mentioned, in a program called Learning by Living, which is actually a program that Marilyn Gallucci of the University of New England is doing with her doctoral students. So she's taking students who volunteer, it's not a requirement, she's taking students from her program, from her doctoral osteopathic medicine program, and setting them up with a nursing home somewhere in Maine or somewhere else in New England, and they live there for somewhere between 9 and 14 days. They live there as a resident. They have certain diagnoses, which I'll get into later. They're served in all the same ways a resident is. It's meant to be as true to the actual experience as possible. I myself had a stay of 9 days and 8 nights, and I was living at the Scarborough Veterans Home in Scarborough, Maine. And I decided to do this program because I knew that to get into design for nursing homes or senior living or even retirement communities, I was going to need to have a better understanding, a better empathy about what's going on at that point in people's lives and what they're going through. Also, my firm is new. We just started it this year. I started it with my wife, who's sitting back. Her name's Sasha. And so I have a little bit more time than I will later, and I'm feeling pretty responsive and receptive to new ideas and learning. So it was a perfect time in my career to go out and do this. The basis for the program is called qualitative ethnobiographical research. And the idea is that a culture, in this case a nursing home, is observed by the researcher, in this case me, as the researcher lives there. So it's the expectation isn't that there's an understanding that by being there, things change a little bit. But the point is to document things as well as you can while you're doing it, and then afterwards spend some time doing analysis and see what you came up with. So it is a technique of doing research, even though it's a little less scientific and data-oriented. Ways in which I sort of affected the outcome is that I was often a point of interest for the residents. So as opposed to them sort of having maybe a less interesting morning, you know, I stopped and talked to them for a little while. Or maybe they followed me around or asked someone else why I was there. But over time, I would say people did get used to me. And there were some things that were different about the home as well. It was a veterans home, so it was mostly men who were residents, which is not typical. And also, the fact that it was a veterans home, it's possible that that could have attracted staff, so they might have had more of a pool of people to choose from for their positions. Oh, and the last thing was I lived in a dementia unit, so for most of the time, for 7 of the nights. So that was not necessarily a typical experience as well. My own diagnoses that I had were, I'm left-handed, so I had left-sided weakness. That meant I was in a wheelchair. It meant that I had to have assistance with all activities, getting in and out of bed, going to the bathroom, cleaning myself. But we sort of, I recovered over the course of my stay. So I was getting more assistance at the beginning, and as the longer I stayed there, I had less sort of hands-on time with the staff, and I even recovered to the point of using a walker before I left. The thing about getting assistance that really struck me was how hard it was to ask for help. And I don't think that's an atypical experience. I mean, there are many cases where the reason people end up in skilled nursing is because of a sudden event. And so they may not be at all interested in asking for help either. And that was just kind of a surprise to me, to be in this position where I knew I was perfectly capable. And it's only a small difference between knowing you're perfectly capable and actually being so, and knowing that you were perfectly capable a month ago, or you know, for most of your life. It's really very similar. Another part of my diagnosis was that I had pneumonia secondary to aspiration. So I was on pureed foods for the first 2 days, and then I graduated to mechanically soft foods, and then I was on a normal diet after that. And I had a drug regimen which consisted of Tic Tacs in the bubble pack that they served me on, I think, twice a day. So those are all different parts of the experience. Both before, during, and after, I took copious amounts of notes and actually was corresponding with Marilyn Gallucci throughout the whole experience. I'd send her my notes on a daily basis, and she would respond. So that was kind of how we, I don't know, kept everything under control from one side, and also sort of gathered the data that she'll use, or the information that I wrote down she'll use as she moves forward with her study. So I do want to be open to questions at any time. If you want to raise your hand and stop me, that's fine. But I can also just charge right along. I'll just kind of walk through my experience at the home. Arrival was much more realistic than we expected. Initially, I was set up to go to the St. Andre's facility in Biddeford, Maine. And they had a substantial intake days before I was supposed to go in, and they couldn't take me. So I had a pre-meeting with them, I had met the staff, we were all on the same page, and then 2 days before my admittance, I got transferred to the Scarborough Veterans Home, and I showed up there. I'd never been there before, I had never met anyone, and so being admitted was very realistic. I had that really strong sense of dread approaching the doorway. At that point, I was, you know, walking in, and I knew in a moment I'd be in a wheelchair for 9 days. And those first hours and then days that I was there, I found that what I was most concerned about was just getting any sort of positive reinforcement from the staff at all. I was very concerned about the fact that I was capable, and yet I had to be here kind of asking for help from people who had jobs to do. And I think this would be a similar experience for anyone being admitted to a facility. The just wanting to know that the staff are there for you. And so when I got there, I was introduced. I arrived in the morning during first shift. I was introduced to the charge nurse and to the person who was going to be assigned to me. And, you know, the reception was lukewarm. They had other things going on. The charge nurse was concerned that I was going to be disrupting activity in his ward or in his wing. And but at least I knew who they were. And I started to settle in, unpack my things. And that, the first shift's change, which came, I don't know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, right after lunch, I was nervous all over again because no one had introduced me to the new staff, and I didn't know who was in charge. And And so it was this sort of frustrating moment. And then, of course, it happened again in the evening right as I was going to bed. The next day, I said, okay, good, we're done with this. I've met everyone. But, of course, it happens again on the weekend. You have a whole new staff again. Or at least everything shifts around enough that it's not recognizable. So that was something that I could not have expected going into it, just this realization of how critical those first staff changes are to a resident. As I was getting through that, I was there. I was admitted on a Wednesday, I think. So I was starting to get used to things by Friday. And so daily living, you know, happened. And some of the things that were, I guess, a high point for my day every day was mealtime. And everything happens slow in a nursing home. That was my experience. So that meals were about half of my waking hours, it seemed like, between getting everyone into the room and situated, and then handing out meals that are very specific. You can't just hand them out willy-nilly. Every single plate needs to be checked to make sure that the right, what is being prescribed, is on the plate. And I learned to enjoy that time, because that was my time to sit and hang out with the residents, and often CNAs would come up to me and tell me some detail about who I was sitting with that day. I sat with someone who had been a race car driver. I sat with someone who had been an editor for the Bangor paper in Maine, one of the major papers, a guy two doors down from me had been a famous artist with, you know, his paintings sold all over the country, maybe the world, I'm not really sure. And so the staff helped me get to know the residents, and I would talk to them at lunchtime in conversations that were, you know, kind of cyclical at times. It was the dementia unit. So I got to work on my conversation skills, kind of like Groundhog Day. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but I got to try the same thing every day and see how I did. My roommate was a relatively private man. Most of the residents were brought out into the common area of the unit every day, and he was someone who liked to stay in his room. And but he was extraordinarily sweet, and we would sit and talk, and I learned a little bit about his time in the Coast Guard. But he was also very hard on himself. So I think it was him who kind of cued me into realizing how important understanding different personalities in a roommate situation, in a whole unit situation, in a whole home situation, how important the personalities are, and I'll talk more about that later. But as it turned out, we were in the room at the end of the hall, so even though he was relatively private, he was getting wandering visitors all the time, right, you know, wandering down the hall straight into his room, and then someone would eventually turn them around and they wander back the other way. Some of the other events that I participated in included bingo. I don't know how many of your homes have bingo, but that was probably the most torturous time I had there. And I want to explain why, just so you guys can think about whether this is the case at your facility. There was no board that displayed what numbers had been called. So what that meant was that you had to listen to hear the number be called, which meant you had a room full of people who were absolutely silent, because if you talked at all, then you wouldn't hear the number be called. So this activity involved just sitting there waiting for numbers to be called, and there was nothing else that could happen. There was no possible way for it to happen. But people won dollar bills, so, you know, it worked out, I think, for some. Another activity that was interesting to me was we had a Hawaiian luau, which was great. You know, everyone got wheeled into the multipurpose room and wore funny hats, and the staff put leis on people, and and there was a DJ playing Jimmy Buffett and the Beach Boys and, I don't know, other beachy songs. But it, once everything was set up and they were serving out food, there was this moment when I realized this, the staff are then responsible to have for having the party because there were so many people confined to their wheelchairs. And it was then that I was sort of struck with how bizarre it is that we have people in one generation separated from all the other generations. Because if it were a family reunion, there'd be plenty of activity happening with the parents and the grandkids doing whatever they're doing. And it wouldn't be so bizarre to have everyone standing, sitting around facing each other with party music playing. So I'll talk more about that too. I think. Sort of an incidental thing that I realized is, as an architect, I think of ramps as an accommodation for people who are in a wheelchair, and I now realize that they are a barrier most of the time, especially in homes where people that are geared towards people being indoors. Ramps in outside situations tend to work okay because when you're in a wheelchair, either it's powered or someone's pushing you. But inside, neither of those things happen as often. And so ramps are nearly impossible to navigate. And especially, I learned how to use a wheelchair with one arm and one leg as opposed to two arms. And that's a really complicated thing to do, and that doesn't work as well on a ramp either. So I will not be using ramps indoors if I can help it. So some of the things I touched on already, and it looks like I'm moving through time pretty fast, so really, any questions, anytime. As I touched on before, the big conclusion I came away with was that if I have the opportunity as an architect, I need to push for nursing facilities, assisted living facilities that are not separated from other age groups, because there's sort of something missing sociologically when you do that. As you get older, the things that are more exciting are what the new generation is going to bring. And to be not allowed to experience that is a real, it's a shame. And so I know that that's a large-scale solution that can't possibly apply to what all of you do every day, but it's something that I hope we can all be aware of and think that if we when we get the chance to do it over again, that's an obvious thing that needs to be considered. And sort of going with that, a nursing home, and if you disagree with me, that's fine. But kind of what I came away from was that we need to remember that the reason we have nursing homes is because there isn't someone available to care for someone in their own home, and that's always the best solution, or to care for them in any home if they move in with someone else. I mean, that's the solution that we all really want to happen, and when that doesn't work out because your care becomes too much or because there's no one nearby, that's when, you know, people move into nursing homes. And the reason that we have nursing homes is because it's so because they're so large, is because it's so expensive to have all the staff there. And so it's just good to keep in mind that, you know, we created this situation. It's kind of based on economy. And so we need to recognize that and then find ways to combat the fact that we're doing something for economy reasons and not for the residents themselves, and see how we can work with that. So if I get the opportunity, I'd like to... Oh, go ahead.
I'm curious, as a resident, how aware were you of the overwhelming regulations that staff have to follow day in and day out?
I was expecting to be much more aware of it. And again, I think my experience could have been skewed by the fact that I was in the dementia unit where just a higher level of involvement was required by the staff. They really seemed to be enjoying their job and doing the tasks that they felt needed to be done. It wasn't perceived that they were doing them because they had to be done. It felt to me like they were doing the things that obviously you would do to take care of someone. But I imagine that that's not always the case. I imagine the regulations are much stronger of a presence in many situations. Yeah. I found that for me, waking up in the morning was something that really shaped my day, at least the first few hours of my day. You know, whether I woke up sort of my own accord or whether I was woken up by a friendly staff member who happened to be nearby and was checking in on me, or whether I was woken up by some kind of emergency event happening two doors down, that feeling really would stay with me for a little while in the morning and would impact basically whether I had a good breakfast, you know. Also, the other part of waking up this is sort of my architect side speaking. I would wake up and I'd be facing up and I would see sort of a dropped gridded ceiling like this. And I would know that I wasn't in a home. I was in some kind of commercial place. And then we had double rooms, and so we had, you know, curtains. And that was another clue right off. Even though there were nice draperies on the windows, I couldn't see them yet. I could just see these, you know, privacy curtains and the commercial ceiling. So I came away sort of thinking that those initial impressions that you get when you wake up every morning can cue you in to where you are in a sort of, in a way that reinforces your motivation to get up, or in a way that kind of deflates your motivation to get up. So if I get the chance, I'd like to try, and I know this has been done before, but I'd like to try nursing homes built in conjunction with elementary schools or daycares or recreational facilities or city halls or libraries. I mean, I could even see a case where an amusement park and a nursing home could make a good match for certain kinds of people. And part of the reason for doing that is because people are car, you know, they can't use the car. Residents often can't use a car. And so if there's not something immediately there, then they're not going to be doing anything outside of the home. And it's also not going to bring anyone in to the home who isn't directly visiting.
I'm wondering about this connection between the structure of the facility and how that demands it makes on the person's daily living. So, for example, it's a setting where the meal's brought to you instead of you serving yourself. And I don't work in a nursing home, but I've heard about nursing homes where the patient's responsible for making their own bed. Or do you think of design concepts in that way? Like what contributes to the person's daily living responsibilities?
Yeah. You know, it probably depends on, you know, sort of a number of factors that directors of nursing could explain better than me. But I've read about sort of care models like that. And based on my experience, it seems that people would enjoy having a little more responsibility. And being, I mean, I don't remember where I read this now, but part of being able to be cared for is being able to care for someone or something as well. If you're just receiving all the time, it kind of creates guilt sometimes, or some kind of uncomfortable feeling. And I'll talk about that more in a second. But to me, it seems like it would be a good way to go. I think I talked about trust a little bit. One thing that was sort of humbling for me is I went into the experience thinking that I would learn a lot about how architecture can make people's lives better. And what I realized is that my role is small in comparison to the role of all the staff members. And so part of what an architect needs to do is focus as much time on the building working well for the staff so that they can focus on the act of caring, which is their primary role. And that's something that I couldn't have learned if I hadn't had this experience. So to get back to your question, those were some of the, I just talked about some of the big things that I would do in a new home. But I also came up with a lot of small fixes that could be done in renovation situations or may not even involve renovation. And I tied those ideas into thinking about people's senses and how they experience their day. You know, the five senses. And there's always been a lot of focus on sight, what things look like, how things are decorated, the signage, the finishes in the floors, the ceiling, the walls. And I think some of the other senses, specifically smell and sound, have been neglected a little bit. And smells, I would like to see, and this isn't a new idea either, but the idea of being served by someone where the food just comes from somewhere, some commercial kitchen, somewhere else in the facility, is kind of just a bummer because you didn't smell it cooking and you didn't know what it was until minutes before it arrived in front of you. And in places where it makes sense, it would be great to have kitchens available in each of the units. And I don't know how many of you have heard of the small house or greenhouse model for nursing homes, but that's actually based around the elimination of the commercial kitchen and the CARE CNA staff become responsible for cooking as well, which puts a lot more responsibility on them, but there's, you know, it's worked out in that model, I think. So the idea of people being able to experience the food being cooked, even if they're not participating, and possibly participate in the preparation of the food, is just sort of another thing that for some could return them to normality. Now, in the veterans' home, I didn't get as much of a desire for that from the guys. They seemed pretty happy being served, but I think it sort of depends on the situation. Also, in terms of smells, I think, you know, really analyzing ventilation systems and making sure that when someone has an accident in their room, that smell isn't going all over the place. There's ways to handle the air so that the air is not going out into the hallway with the ventilation systems. That's really important because if you, at any point, smell poop, then you know you're not at home because it doesn't usually smell like poop. And then with the sounds, one of the most grating parts of the experience for me was the many alarms and call bells that happen in the unit. There's seat alarms, there's sometimes bed alarms, there may be even alarm on a door for certain folks, you know, if they open their door, someone's going to know. Then, of course, the call bells themselves. And the solution isn't as much architectural, but it is something that I think is going to be available to most facilities soon, switching from, you know, physical interface units that are mounted somewhere to handheld units where all the alarms go through the handheld and they vibrate. That's going to make a huge difference. And for facilities that have the ability to simply use less alarms and be conscious about doing that when they are going to make audible noises, I think is a big step in the right direction as well.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
I have worked at a facility that had the handheld pagers, and it was interesting because the residents could not see or hear anything going on, and they would ring all the time for fear that nobody saw that they had done a call. They preferred the
interesting. I can understand that. Yeah.
From a director of nurses' point of view, when it went through the pager, I had no idea whether a nurse's aide answered the bell or not. But when the bell stopped, I knew that they had answered the call.
Yeah.
So when I left that facility and went to a facility with a buzzer, I would like to change the buzzer out for something as a pleasant noise, but I like it much better.
Huh.
So I'm old school on that.
Yeah. Well, it's something that I think, you know, facilities will continue to grapple with, and there'll probably be all kinds of different solutions.
A pleasant noise.
Yeah, pleasant noise. Not a dog barking or something.
No.
In the program, were there any opportunities for you to challenge the norm? For instance, you said that you were on a pureed diet when you first went in. Were there any opportunities for you to say, but I don't like this, can I have something different?
I think that some of the doctoral students did a little more of that. But as a professional going into the facility, I didn't feel comfortable making the staff's day difficult. And in fact, the services that they provided me were slightly diminished in terms of while bathing and going to the bathroom. We kind of laid off on that a little bit because I just didn't. I couldn't do it. And they were grateful too. I mean, so. I think there could have been an opportunity, but I didn't take it.
My name is Mark Layton. I work for Marjorie, who's in the front row. Marjorie's home is under state survey, so I apologize for being a little late. Can you speak to your experience in the movie?
Yeah. What can I say about it?
Was it your first time in?
It was my first time in a wheelchair. And actually, I think this is one of those odd places where my experience as an architect actually helped me. I've seen so many diagrams of bathrooms and how people are supposed to get around in a wheelchair during the course of my work that I knew which way I was supposed to be facing in many of those situations when I was trying to maneuver my chair. And there were reports from many of the students in the program having difficulties with some of the tasks that I kind of knew how to handle already. So that's one part of it. But I imagine you were...
Emotionally.
I don't know. I'm kind of an optimist. So it was certainly difficult to move around outside. I found it frustrating. There was a paved walkway around the facility that was relatively flat, but very, you know, but quite bumpy. And, you know, I had difficulty doing it, but I saw it as a challenge, I guess. I think that to have, I think it would have eventually been grating on me, but my experience was, it was limited. It was only, you know, a week and a half.
Did your body get sore?
The cushion was amazing. It did not get sore. I don't know what the cushion was made out of, but my butt didn't get sore, and they just pulled a random wheelchair out of the closet, but it fit me relatively well. I actually had more difficulty with soreness during the first few days when I wasn't moving around on my own really at all. And so when I got put into bed at night, just sort of sitting there in bed was uncomfortable for me. And
when you were first introduced to yeah. When you approached an interview as soon as like emergency first.
Yes. That is, there was a little bit of that, but it was, my admittance kind of happened fast, and the charge nurse wasn't told about it ahead of time, and quite frankly was pretty pissed that I was being admitted to his unit. Yeah. And he let me know that, and, you know, said, okay, I have to ask you these questions. And we just kind of went down it really fast. And we became friends later. I don't know what was going on with him that day. But I wouldn't be surprised to find that that happens occasionally to real on real admissions anyway. I mean, people try to be on their best behavior. But,
sure. You had mentioned your arm was weak and your leg was too.
Yes.
How was that communicated about the stress process?
It was a stroke, post-stroke situation. Is that kind of what you were asking?
Yeah.
So I just had lost my ability to understand how to move it. I guess I'm not, I didn't go to medical school,
yeah,
so I don't.
What I'm trying to feel is, because I'm very envious of your experience, is the discussion with, once he was, I mean, he was aggravated, but he wanted to do the right thing by you. Was the communication between the two, you talking about you have this weakness and you need to address that? Or was it talking about you had an arm and a leg that were really strong, right? Conversation? How did he learn about...
So I was admitted at the beginning. So... this was part of a program done by Marilyn Gallucci out of the University of New England. Did you catch any
of
it?
Some of us heard.
Okay. So she came in with me, and she was considered to be my adult daughter. So in playing that role, she explained much of that to him. She said, this is my dad. You know, he just had a stroke, and he just has some weakness. And so they kind of left me out of the conversation a little bit.
Did, in your 24 hours, did you get yourself up and stretch? Did you get assistance from staff to assist you up and about?
Because I had so many notes to take, and I was using both hands to type into my laptop, after being put to bed officially, that was considered off time, and I would get up and stretch then. I would stand up and do some stretching.
Okay, so in your stretching, I'm with you on this, you were not limited on that side.
No.
You were out
no.
of character.
Yes, exactly. And I was out of character much more than the students have been when they've gone through the program. because I wasn't as focused on the care specifically as they would have been. I was also focused on the architecture, and we felt that taking up staff time wasn't as necessary.
One more quick question.
Yeah.
If you projected not being able to do that within 2 weeks, and you had that limitation on your arm and your leg, what would you be hoping for?
I would be so much looking forward to my physical therapy sessions, because I would know that at that time someone was going to be asking me how I was feeling, theoretically, and working with me to move the parts of my body that I was having trouble with. And I'm sure you all know this, because of how the billing system works for physical therapy, they couldn't squeeze me in to do any of that, to actually have that experience. But I sat in and watched some other people having physical therapy sessions. An occupational therapy session.
And one more question. If you were on a chair on a mat,
I was.
Please tell me about this as well. Okay. You were on it for 2 weeks?
I was on it for 7 days.
Did it go off often?
Yeah.
What caused it to go off?
Me getting up.
Were you adjusting your
Oh, it didn't go off often when I was sitting in my chair. But as I said, we laid off the bathroom thing, so I forgot every single time, and I would get up, and the darn thing would go off.
And what did you think of this device?
Oh, well, the whole beeping conversation has to do with that device for me. I know someone's going to speak about fall prevention next, and I'm dying to hear what they talk about, because my perception was that some of the fall prevention measures that are in place have more to do with keeping the facility safe insurance-wise than what the residents need. So I'm interested to hear about that. And that it was something that bothered me. So I don't think there's a lot more on here. Just a couple other notes. I've got 2 more minutes. Something to keep in mind, I don't know how many of you actually deal with sort of the facilities side, but the baby boomers are not as likely to like Victorian style of homes as sort of people who are in homes now. And so, and when I say Victorian style, I'm sort of referring to lots of crown molding and flowery curtains and Persian rugs and all these kinds of things, they're all going to probably need to be redone. So it's just something to think about, that there are other styles out there, you know, farmhouse, camp, shaker, modern. And go ahead.
Just before you break, you talked about, you know, kind of your experience.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, wow. I just remembered that I was going to answer a question of yours a long time ago. A bread maker is a good substitution for a kitchen.
The
room itself. Well, I know that a lot of, well, this isn't a good, I'm not going to say, going from taking a room that was a double room and making it a single room, a lot of people are doing that, but that's not a simple fix. That's a big thing. It's tough. Again, my personal experience was on the sounds is a big one, and that's not exactly architectural, but it's something to try and tackle. But simple things can certainly involve lighting that isn't overhead lighting, sort of. And in particularly in the public areas, where it's appropriate, because it's not always appropriate, being able to dim it in the evening can create a calming effect, and I watched it happen in the dementia unit every day. So over time, allowing people a little more personal lighting control that feels more like, you know, reading lamps and sort of more task-oriented lighting is good in situations where it's appropriate. I know for, you know, cleaning and staff, you know, having bright lighting in certain situations is needed. So that's a big one. Being sensitive to finishes that perform commercially but don't look so commercial. Like, I mean, this wooden floor is kind of an example of that. This ceiling is not. There aren't a lot of alternatives for ceilings, but where sort of a traditional plaster ceiling can be done, that's also, depending on situation improvement, that can be done, maybe not. But replacing flooring, in most cases, it ends up being wood, something that looks like wood or stone. Actually, it did make a difference in my perception of the place. And similarly, where you have chail rows or rails or wainscoting or bump guards all down a hallway, if you can look at that and make it a material that has a natural texture to it. Natural textures, I think, particularly with people who are having memory issues, they're familiar and not oppressive. Did I miss anything, Sasha?
No.
Sometimes she has suggestions on the sort of the more affordable side. Those are the obvious ones for me, I guess. If anyone has any other ideas, I'm welcome to. I would welcome them. And so one of the last things that I mentioned while I was talking, I've gone over, just one more second, is the need to recognize individuals. And the way that was particularly notable to me was my roommate, who was kind of introverted, but enjoyed being at the end of the hallway where he could see down the whole hallway, but wanted to be in his room as opposed to out in the common area. Sort of got me thinking about how, as a field, as an industry, both what you do and what I do, we don't really recognize the continuum of sociability, and at least I haven't come across research that talks about, well, how sociable is a person and how would their environment respond to that? Or how we care for them respond to that? And so that's something I'd like to investigate more, and something that, you know, could be good for all of us to think about. And I think I'll stop there. Any other questions?
So that you could learn and then sharing that with us.
Thank you. Marilyn always says this, so I should say it. You know, we can always just ask the residents, too.
Duh.
But thanks.